This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Rescue operations are underway along Island Park Road in South Lee County right now as people are stranded in their homes due to impassable streets, which have become waterways thanks to record-setting rainfall over the past 3 days. People are kayaking to check on stranded neighbors. And according to the Fort Myers News Press, 35 people have been rescued by boat this morning. In Cape Coral, people are being advised to stay off the roads. And once the water clears, officials urge caution as potholes may appear. On Sanibel, police are reporting roadways open and passable, but urging caution as drivers face several inches of standing water. Schools in Lee and Collier counties were closed today, with system officials waiting until 5 p.m. to decide what's in store for tomorrow. Right now, the sun is shining in parts of southwest Florida, giving hope that things are finally drying out. Let's check with Florida Public Radio's emergency network meteorologist Jeff Huffman to see if the rain really is over. So, Jeff, we're seeing a lot of water falling here in southwest Florida, and then on the other side of the Gulf, we're hearing about Hurricane Harvey, but these are two separate systems, right?
Yes. Good morning, or good afternoon, Julia. They are two separate systems, but they're also experiencing very little steering winds aloft. So for the same reasons that the system in Texas is not moving is sort of the same reason the system in the Eastern Gulf didn't move over the weekend. But as you mentioned, a little bit of sunshine today and a lot more tomorrow. We're going to move out of this weather pattern in the next 24 hours.
So the forecast right now is calling for no rain?
No, there will be some additional rain today, this afternoon. We're going to likely see some more bands of rain move on shore from the Gulf. The rain is going to start to focus a little more to the north today. This axis of moisture that's been stalled over southwest Florida is going to drift north into the I-4 corridor by this evening. And this is all kind of in response to this disturbance that's moving across the state, now becoming a tropical cyclone over the western Atlantic, northeast of Jacksonville. The upper-level steering currents are starting to strengthen, and it's going to start to pull away from the state of Florida by midweek.
So what we have now is still called, just considered an invest?
It is actually called a potential tropical cyclone. It's okay. Just the name given from the National Hurricane Center. It's not officially a cyclone just yet, but they started this year where they name it a potential cyclone so that they could issue watches and warnings for areas that might see tropical storm conditions. There is a tropical storm warning in effect for parts of North Carolina because of the anticipated conditions from a developing system in the next 36 hours.
So once our temperatures stabilize and become kind of back to what is the normal, are we going to be seeing our afternoon storms coming back in a little while?
Yeah, I'm expecting a typical August pattern, late August pattern to resume by probably as early as tomorrow and especially Wednesday and Thursday. There'll be sea breeze activity each and every day, but we do have to watch kind of the trailing moisture from Harvey. Obviously not to the scope of what's happening in Texas or Louisiana, but as the system moves north into the Tennessee Valley, it will have this connection still to the Gulf of Mexico. I think it's mainly going to be focused up in the Panhandle in North Florida, but we'll still have to watch this closely to see how much of Harvey's moisture move across the state. That would not be until this weekend. So I know it's been a really soggy, messy weekend, but good news is conditions are improving. Just keep in mind we have some rivers that have flood warnings in effect, including the Lafayette River and the Manatee Rivers. Those will continue through the middle of the week.
Is there any possibility of any bands redeveloping from Harvey as it moves north?
Well, directly related to the system, no. But there will be this moisture pool that still lingers, and that's what may move in this weekend. But I, like I said, the confidence on that's pretty low. I think it's going to be more the Panhandle and parts of North and Central Florida.
Okay. So is it weird to have two really, really wet storms like this just kind of stalled out?
Not really. Obviously, what happened in Texas is unprecedented in the sense that it was a Category 4, and then it stalled, and now it's moving back over the water. But tropical systems have had a long history of stalling in this vicinity of the United States, especially this time of year. We're kind of caught between the stronger westerly winds that develop in the fall that tend to pull systems northward versus those trade winds that start to weaken a little bit this time of year. But basically, this is not unheard of. In fact, you know, I hate to say this, but what happened in Texas theoretically could happen someday in Florida. We've had stalling tropical systems before, and that's one of the reasons why we should all be prepared. Even if you don't live near a creek or a stream or the ocean, you're in a flood zone in the state of Florida, and that couldn't be more true as to what happened in Texas over the weekend. I mean, many residents in Houston that never anticipated flooding are getting unfortunately flooded out of their homes this morning.
It's really been enormously impactful, that water. So I want to thank you for joining us, Jeff. Jeff Huffman is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, and you can expect updates on southwest Florida weather this afternoon on All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeff.
My pleasure.
We now turn to another meteorologist, Brian Norcross, the senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. He just released a book entitled My Hurricane Story. It's a minute-by-minute recalling of the storm of Hurricane Andrew, during which he spent 23 hours straight on the air talking South Florida through what was the most destructive hurricane to ever hit the state. The hurricane destroyed more than 63,000 homes, caused more than $26 billion in damage, and claimed 65 lives. Brian Norcross, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
We are talking about hurricanes past and present with meteorologist Brian Norcross. You can become part of this conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Brian, we had previously scheduled this show with Hurricane Andrew and your new book in mind, and here we are watching Hurricane Harvey over Texas and dealing with our own little invest here in South Florida. How would you compare this weekend with the passing of Hurricane Andrew 25 years ago?
Well, very different storms, but, you know, tremendous amount of just widespread pain in terms of people being homeless and driven out of their homes and, you know, people without means with really no place to go. I mean, the Hurricane Harvey story parallels the Andrew story in the sense that after Andrew, you had a tremendous amount, a number of people that did not have functioning homes, but were very reluctant to leave their homes. And some of them, it took weeks or even maybe a month before they finally gave up and finally, you know, left their neighborhood and their home and kind of left their past life behind. It's really hard, even when your home is wrecked, to especially if you don't really have, you know, the money and aren't used to going and staying in hotels and doing things like that. It's tough to leave everything you know. So they're going to deal with that in Houston. The Houston story is really just beginning. You know, they rescued people that were in dire straits, but so they got a couple thousand people out, and they've got some more to go in that situation. But they have tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, that are in homes that really are not livable, that are going to have to be dealt with in some way or the other.
It's still sorting itself out. Let's go back to Hurricane Andrew. It was a Category 5 hurricane that struck Florida in August of 1992. Had that been predicted? I mean, did you know that was coming?
Well, we knew that a bad hurricane was coming. At the time, it was originally forecast to be a Category 2, and then a Category 3, and then a Category 4. And at the measurement at the time, based on the science of 1992, was that it hit a Category 4. The data was then reanalyzed 10 years later because new science came along in the late 90s, and this new research allowed that data, same data, to be analyzed differently, data from the Hurricane Hunter airplanes. And so the estimate now of the wind, peak wind was 165 miles an hour sustained and gusting to about 200, which is a, you know, a top end tornado, but 25 miles wide. So it was stunning, but you know, so we knew it was going to be bad, Joy, but we had no picture in my mind of what actually happened, even though I knew, I came to the conclusion in the few hours before it hit that it was going to be essentially worst case. I just couldn't even imagine what worst case meant in real life.
That's a hard thing to anticipate, even though you're in the business of it, until you actually experience it. When Hurricane Andrew did hit, you and your crew went into what's become known as the bunker, where you continued to broadcast. What made you think of taking the camera in with you to the safe space in your building?
Well, you know, we had extensive hurricane plans. We were actually able to stay on the air and function and get information because we had put backup systems in that other TV stations had not done, and we ended up needing them all. And so I had in my mind all kinds of things that we would do, and that was not one of them. But as the storm was just becoming the most extreme imaginable hurricane, and I saw this very intense cell develop on the north side of the eye, I thought, you know, might that kind of wing downtown Miami where we were because I had convinced myself that the eye wall, the worst of it, was going to come in south of us, but only by about 10 miles. I mean, not way south, you know. And then, I saw this very intense cell developing. I looked up at the ceiling in the studio in this old building that the television station was located in, and I thought, I wonder if the roof here really is okay if the thing were to jog just a little bit to the north and we were get that intense cell. And I thought, maybe we should go ahead and move. And then quickly my thinking went to, you know, if we move, that will tell people how serious we are, because we had been telling people for the last couple hours, get ready to move to your safe spot, to your interior closet, your hallway, your bathroom, get a mattress off the bed, and that's going to be your last line of defense. But we were sitting on the shiny news desk. So the thoughts, you know, immediately morphed into, if we could find a place to move, that would be good for our communications and motivate people. And the studio crew was terrific, and they converted this storage room that was just off the set, as it turned out. And we did move in there, and after the fact, I heard from hundreds or thousands of people that said that was the thing that motivated them to actually take action and get out of the living room, get out of the bedroom, and get to the interior of the house somehow, and you know, quite often get under the mattress and ride the storm out that way.
That is so interesting that leading by example is what caused people to actually get up and go move into their areas where they would be safer.
Yeah, communications is a complicated thing. You know, people don't change their general habits easily. You know, and nobody in their home wants to acknowledge that some monster is coming and they need to get under some mattress in the hallway or in a closet. I mean, they can hear those words, but you know, the initial impulse, I think, is, oh, it's not going to happen to me. I've never heard of anything like that. I've never seen anything like that. And actually, I never had ever suggested anybody get under a mattress until that night, when I saw this ultra extreme event coming that I knew would exceed the building code of every building, you know, in South Dade, that Southern Miami-Dade County now, that it was going to encounter.
And this is an era that was before smartphones, before the internet, before quick access to advice or hurricane checklists, and people really relied on TV. So you sat there in that bunker and you took calls on the air from really frightened people. You told in your book the story of a woman named Debbie who called in. Can you tell me about some of those calls that came in to you?
Yeah, this happened about midway through the hurricane. It really started about 4 a.m. when the first really strong winds came ashore, even though they were picking up for the couple hours before that. And about 5:30, we got our first call from a viewer in. Now, I never knew whether that was because the phones weren't working before that, or because the news department didn't route them in, or nobody was calling. I can't believe nobody was calling, because they had been calling for days. So I'm not sure why we suddenly got these calls, but they routed them into the bunker, and this young voice was on the phone with her family in a room, and her brother and father were trying to hold the door, and it was an interior door, and the wind outside was blowing through the house. Part of the roof had been ripped off, and so they were getting the force of the hurricane in the house, and the door was kind of bowing, and they wanted to know if they should leave there and leave that room, and I said, no, definitely not. You all get everybody on that door and hold that door, you know, which was a little a scary thing to give advice about, because I really didn't know the whole situation. But the basic premise is that you keep yourself away from the hurricane. You know, you don't expose yourself to the direct winds of the hurricane and the debris that's flying around. However, you can do that, whether it's under a mattress or, in this case, this family inside their room there, holding the door in a part of the house that was still intact. So just based on that general premise, that was my suggestion to her. And then, we hung up from her and another young voice. I don't know why each of these families had, I think, a teenage daughter was the person who called. I don't know how that happened, but in any case, it was a similar sort of thing. They were barricaded in a room trying to hold on and trying to, you know, hold on against the storm that had already ripped the roof off a part of the house, and the wind was whistling through.
And there you are on the air. You've been 23 hours on the air, nonstop, running, I guess, on pure adrenaline and coffee, I would imagine. Did you realize that while you were spending that time on the air, people were really relying on you for practical advice? One man heard you say, drag a mattress over your head. He did, and he later credits you with saving his life. Did you realize that you were being that impactful at the time that you were doing it, or did that come later?
No, that came later. I knew that I felt good about what we were doing. I felt good that, you know, we had made predictions. I had, you know, looked at the meteorology, looked at the situation, and predicted this is what you're going to need to do. This is what we're going to need to do as a community. What I didn't know, I had no idea what was going on elsewhere in the media. I had no idea how many people had transistor radios. I did confirm that we were on the radio as well, again, because we had put in a dedicated line from our TV studio to the radio station transmitter, so that even when they evacuated their studio, their engineer actually took that wire from the phone company and put it right into the transmitter, and that's how we were on the radio. And that was one of the backup systems. So, you know, I knew we were good on the radio, but I didn't know who else was giving advice or talking people through the storm, or I didn't know what else was happening. Later, I found that two of the stations had gone off the air and did not have a backup connection to the radio station, so they weren't able to do anything, and the other station had to evacuate their studio, so they were sort of incapacitated. So, you know, people tended to gravitate toward me and our station, and so I had this kind of unified response after the fact, that people could almost recite minute by minute exactly what they heard. You know, they were hanging on every word, which when you think about it, you know, they're scared to death in their homes in the dark. And so a voice coming out of the transistor radio is extraordinarily important at that point.
Kind of like a lifeline.
Yeah.
We are talking about hurricanes past and present with meteorologist Brian Norcross. You can become part of this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So, Brian, while it's not the most dramatic video and doesn't usually get as much airtime as whipping winds and buildings that are being blown away, we're often told that water is the most damaging thing a hurricane brings. And we're seeing that in Texas right now. Why do you think people are always blindsided by the flooding that hurricanes bring?
Well, you have two kinds of flooding, remember. You have the storm surge flooding, which is the ocean or the gulf or the bay rising up and coming ashore with velocity, and that causes tremendous destruction like we saw in Hurricane Sandy, for example. All those beach communities that were ruined for 100 miles in Hurricane Sandy, that was because of the force of the ocean water being pushed up, in the case of Sandy, 6, 9, 10 feet, and coming ashore. Then you have the other situation like we're having, and we had that, by the way, in Rockport, Texas, for example, if you saw the pictures out of the initial landfall there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have this just tremendous, unbelievable rain, 20 inches or so of it that came in one 6 or 8 hour period in Houston. And that, you know, that's not a deadly kind of rain, and if people don't drive in it, usually the fatalities that come with that kind of rain are related to automobiles more than houses, because that's a relatively slow rising water that doesn't move with velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people can generally get above. In Houston, they told people, don't go in the attic, go on the roof if you get flooded out of your house, if the water inside your house becomes too high that you can't stay inside. Then they actually rescued a couple thousand people that apparently had gone to roofs or other very high ground because they couldn't stay in their homes. So the situation in Houston is not the life-threatening quality of the water as much as it is the widespread nature of the water, this unprecedented the size of the disaster area there, because Houston is so flat. And the drainage works, but it only works at a certain speed. It's very much like South Florida. It's a flat place. There is drainage, but it doesn't go down right away. So it's just going to take a while for that water to leave and go into the drainage systems. And with it continuing to rain, not a lot, but enough, plus they're releasing water from the reservoirs, which keeps the drainage system called the bayous there, the main bayou, keeps that flooding. It's just going to be a good while before this settles down, you know. And on the river basins, it may take weeks. It probably will take weeks, as a matter of fact. There are rivers outside of the city of Houston that are in major flood stage as well.
Well, here in Southwest Florida, you say that ours could be an area most heavily impacted by flooding and water. We're having a little taste of that as we're dealing with extensive flooding from a little invest, not even a tropical storm that stalled out over us over the weekend. What would have happened here if a rain dumper like Harvey were to stall out here instead of over Houston?
Well, so Southwest Florida is, for the most part, flat, and the water, you know, when you dump a couple of feet of water on the city, everywhere that there's pavement or a house, that water goes somewhere else and floods, or it stays on the street. So you know, you would have widespread flooding. Now, the thing is, in Florida, we have a little better building code than they do in Texas, and we pay a little more attention to where we build. So it really depends on you know, where your house, how your house is built, your building is built, relative to where how the water drains from your neighborhood. But we would expect entire neighborhoods underwater and extensively in a flood like the Houston flood. The big threat in Southwest Florida, however, and it is one of the biggest threats in the United States, is from storm surge, from a hurricane. And the thing that makes it especially difficult in Southwest Florida is that hurricanes can be in the Caribbean 2 days before they hit, you know, in your area there. And so when a hurricane's in the Caribbean, even if it's forecast to come up into the Gulf, it's not necessarily thought of as being a big threat. And the forecast, let's say the forecast generally takes it to, you know, to go back to the Charlie scenario, the forecast generally takes it to go to Tampa. You know, would people in Fort Myers Beach evacuate when the cone is aimed at Tampa, even if ordered to do so? And the odds are a significant percentage wouldn't. And if the storm actually came close to the Caloosahatchee River, you'd end up with houses completely underwater and water moving at velocity that people could not get away from. So that's the real danger in Southwest Florida. Not that, you know, freshwater flooding would not be terrible and would not, you know, just damage large areas and big neighborhoods, but the life-threatening kind of flooding comes from the Gulf of Mexico.
It's interesting that you say that, because you kind of talked a little bit earlier about people's reluctance to leave their home even when it's horribly damaged. There's a certain level of denial that can come into play for people, though, especially when they haven't really seen much of a storm for a long time.
That's exactly right. And well, that's why what we really want people to do is think out the evacuation thoughts ahead of time. Right? Everybody that lives anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico or in low-lying areas or in mobile homes or any kind of home that's not built really well has to consider evacuating for a hurricane affecting Southwest Florida. Now, that, you know, that's a whole process that you have to gear yourself up for evacuating and think about, what am I going to take and what am I going to leave, and leaving my home behind and leaving everything I know behind. And so we really would hope that people would find a way to think about that ahead of time and to accept in their heart that when the evacuation order comes, that this is what I'm going to do, and this is where I'm going to go, and if I hear that there might be an evacuation order coming, that I'm even going to get out sooner so that I don't get caught in the traffic and the headache, and I have a plan for that. You know, we live in Florida. We benefit from the benefits of Florida, from the sunshine, and we don't shovel snow and everything else. But we do live with this hurricane threat, and just like if we lived in Michigan, we'd all buy winter coats. Well, we live in Florida. That means we need to have evacuation plans, and we need to think these things out. It's just part of life in the zone that we live in.
And I wanted to ask about Hurricane Andrew. Since Hurricane Andrew, do you think that we're sitting in any better shape as a result of building code changes or other emergency planning that has come into effect as a result of what happened 25 years ago?
Well, the two things you touched on, the building codes and the emergency planning, both are to the better. Now, the building codes in Miami-Dade and Broward County are terrific, and they're the strongest building codes in the world. People all over the world talk about the Miami-Dade code. Does that meet the Miami-Dade standard when they talk about windows or shutters or shingles or siding or anything else? That's the gold standard in the world. Unfortunately, the rest of Florida doesn't use that standard. They use a lesser standard, and I think that's foolish and unsafe. But that's the way our legislature has decided to adopt a code in the state of Florida. Not that it's not a pretty good code, but it's not a code up to the kind of hurricanes that we can get anywhere in coastal Florida. But that's still much better than it was before Hurricane Andrew. Also, emergency management offices are tremendously better at every level, local, state, and federal. On the other side, though, we have so many more people with not really many more roads for people to leave. It's basically the same road system that it always was, maybe a lane here or there, but certainly not commensurate with the increase in the number of people. And it's much harder to communicate with people today than it was in 1992. As you said, in 1992, people knew to turn on the television.
Yeah, communication is very fragmented now.
Right. And now, not only is it fragmented, in addition to that, people don't really believe what they hear so much anymore, you know? Not that the people believed everything in 1992, but generally there was an acceptance in the public that the media and people that were providing instructions, you know, had their best interests at heart. Now we tend to think of ulterior motives and there are a lot of conspiracies and all that, which of course is fed by uninformed opinions and people that just want to cause trouble. So you have that issue, which is you have to break past that to communicate with people. Then you also have the fact that our major communication systems are not as robust as they were in 1992. You know, back then, everybody had what then we called a transistor radio, but a portable radio that you could sit on the kitchen counter or sit on the living room table after the power went out, and everybody in the family could follow the coverage that came through the radio, probably via a television station, but through a radio station. Now, you have a fraction of the people that have even a radio to participate in that, and they just depend so much on their cell phones and on the internet, neither of which are robust, as we saw when Harvey came ashore in that area in Rockport, Texas, to the east of Corpus Christi. There was no cell phone service.
Yeah, those towers go down and you're out of luck.
And you're out of luck, right. And so if you don't have, and there are all these people that didn't have a radio and didn't know what was going on, so you have that problem, then which I think is the major public safety problem of the modern era, that people don't have radios. Then aggravating that, as you know, the media business is nowhere near as robust as it was in 1992. So many radio stations are automated, or many fewer people, or less experienced people, and not to mention television stations. It's the same thing. You just have newsrooms have shrunk in general, and the experience level of the people has decreased as the amount of money in the system has decreased. And then compounding that is the telephone system, is that back in 1992, most people had home phones. Everybody had a home phone if they had a telephone, and it was what was called a POTS line, plain old telephone service. And those phones continued to work after the power went out. So I remember being in South Dade in the disaster zone there, and I found a princess phone. you know what a princess phone is.
I had one of those, yes.
A little, you know, pale blue princess phone. I picked it up. There was a dial tone. It was sitting in the yard in the back, you know, with a wire that just ran across the ground because the phone system then was so robust because it didn't rely on local electricity. It only relied on a connection back to the phone company central office. So in many, many areas, that kind of service is not even available today. And most people that have home phones have it going through the cable company because it's cheaper that way. And so that's not a robust system. That's not that's an electricity-dependent system. So anyway, on multiple levels, communication is going to be much more difficult in the disasters of the future, the hurricanes of the future. Luckily, in Houston, that's not been a problem because the power has generally stayed on in the city there. Enough power has stayed on that people have been able to, you know, find out what's going on.
All right. Well, we are going to have to leave it there for now, but I really want to thank our guest, meteorologist and senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel, also author of the new book, My Hurricane Andrew Story, just in time for the storm's 25th anniversary. A riveting read. Thanks so much for being part of our show, Brian Norcross.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll continue our look back at past Florida storms with those who lived through Hurricane Charley back in 2004. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.